Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this new series, Introduction to Midrash. I'm giving this series at the request of my grandmother, who's also on the call. She's very interested in Midrash, so she wanted to know more about what exactly is a Midrash. So before we get into the thick of what it means to what is Midrash, let me first ask the audience, so both that the person audience and the online audience, just try and raise your hand either physically or digitally, and then that way we can all have a chance to say what we want to say. So the first question is, what does everybody think of when you hear the term Midrash, right? When you hear Midrash, right, what do you think of? So, any thoughts? Go in person first.
It's a way of interpreting Chumash, or the Torah. It's a form of interpreting the Torah.
Good. A way of interpreting the Torah, right? So that's would be Midrash, right? From the word Darash to expound. So you're expounding the verses of the Torah. Okay, but what else would people comes to mind? You think hear the word Midrash. Feel free to unmute everybody who's digital. If you've got a thought,
a bit of poetic, perhaps poetic license with the text.
Poetic license with the text. Okay. What else?
Sermon.
Stories.
Stories. That's Stuart.
A sermon. A drush. Yeah, we drush.
Very good. We will get there. Those are also in it. So we've got all these different things that we're saying are part of Midrash. We say when you, let's say if I were to say, for instance, the Midrash says, I'm sure everybody here has seen those books, right? So is the Midrash, let's say, an individual, right? Is there a guy named Midrash who's speaking to us?
There are several different kinds of Midrashim.
Right.
There are several authors.
Right. As Mark is correctly pointing out, there are several different types of Midrashim. Right. So there are some that are somebody's opinion on or again generally Tannaitic sages about what happened, but not exclusively. So as simple as it may be presented when we were little reading or as we're reading it to our kids, right, of the Midrash says or little Midrash says, it's not quite so simple. So let's first define what exactly a Midrash is. So a Midrash is a collection of Tannaitic statements, right? So as in, I know that's not so helpful, so I'm going to try and make it a little clearer, okay? So when I say that there's a collection of Tannaitic statements, I mean it's a collection of Tannaitic statements, often a dialogue, that sometimes actually wound up arguing, because it's not simply one person's opinion, it's a collection of various Tannaitic sages, various rabbis saying what they have to say. And they're not only stories. So but when I say not only stories, what do I mean by that? So if you were to group it generally, there's two basic breakdowns to Midrash. Okay, so anybody have any guesses as to what are the two basic types?
Agadic and Halachic? Sorry, Miriam, if you were going to say that, I jumped.
Yes, excellent, Stuart. You got it, right? Halachic and Agadic Midrashim. Right, so when we say halachic, so we're going to go a little more in depth as to what each of these means. So halachic meaning that we're expounding the verses of the Torah to understand what the halacha is, right? What does the verse mean? Because, you know, the Torah has a lot of mitzvot, a lot of different laws that we need to know about. So we need to know. But there's also some midrashim that are primarily more literary or story-oriented, and those we would call the agadic midrashim. But as far as the actual midrashim, so everybody here can sees this. Again, I apologize for the chart being in Hebrew as well as it being very small. So I'm going to try and switch to another thing, see if that's easier for people to see. I see Miriam had said that it was a story here. So let's see if this makes it easier. Can everybody? Hang on a second. Can everybody see? Is this version better? Here we go. Is that a little clearer? So you see that you see these columns? So this is the historical breakdown of the Midrashim, right? If you want to make it bigger, let's see, can I? Yeah, I can, good. There we go, historical breakdown. So first and foremost, need to cite the person who a lot of this is based off of. So there is There is a book called Vavol Midrashim by Reizel. I have her book in person here. Brought it all the way from Israel. Somebody, for those who are in person, you're welcome to, you know, to leaf through it if you want. It's also online at mayim.org.il. So she goes through and explains a lot of the types of it. So as far as that chart, so that chart's also found in the book, and it's unpacking an insane amount of detail all at once. So we're going to try and explain what's going on with this chart. So first, let's zoom out again. So notice on top here, it says Me'ah and then a century, right? So this is saying what century was the Midrash written during. So you'll notice that we go from the 3rd century, right? Meaning the 200s, all the way until the 1300s, right? So we've got about 1,000 years or so during which Midrashim were compiled.
There's no concept of a modern day Midrash. Did the canon end at a certain point?
So the answer is no, but for our purposes, yes. Meaning, as in a Midrash, meaning a homiletical interpretation or an expansive interpretation of the text. So many of the modern day drasha that you might hear in shul might fall into this category. Just you happen to have been a sage who's not from the right era. But as far as fitting in, it would definitely fit in. So let me zoom out again. You'll see that there's some of them were compiled in a given century, some were several centuries, and we'll hopefully over the course of the series be able to go through all of them. But it just may take a little while. So you'll see here. So we mentioned. So I'm going to go back to the PowerPoint, and then hopefully. Wrong way. Who knows that one? Yeah, there we go. Okay. So again, we'll come back to the chart. But for now, know that there are different types. As far as the general, actually, I'll split on the bottom corner here. We're not going to go through all of them because, again, if anybody would like to know more, I'm happy to email you the source sheet as well as, again, this chart can be found online. So you'll see there's a lot of different midrashim on different books. So you'll see that there's a basic five types. So for today's purposes, just need about the first three, right? So the Midrashei Halakha, which are the halakhic works. Then we have the Midrashei Agadah Parshaniyim, which is the story type works that are meant to interpret the verses. And then we have, in terms of, let's say, you know, like when we say part, like, you know, when you think, let's say a commentary, let's say Rashi or Ramban, those are examples of, so that's more of a parshan, right? A commentator on a text, as opposed to Midrashei Agadah Darshaniyim, which is, fits better with, let's say, modern day drasha, where it's, you know, based in the text, but a lot of it's outside of the text, and it's not necessarily what the verse strictly means.
Can I ask you a question based on what you're saying? When you're interpreting the text, and let's say you're using the techniques for interpreting the text, like Kal Vachomer, etc., we can understand that there's sort of a logical approach. But when you're interpreting the text, and what you're getting is the Midrash says that Avraham stood in a keep Shan Ha'esh. The author of that Midrash, the original author, where is he getting this from? Are we saying it's divinely inspired? Is he making it up? Is there some pre-source to his original source?
That is an excellent question. So we will address parts of that today. Parts that will have to remain for future weeks. But the simple answer is that it's not that they're making it up. Generally, a midrash will have a textual basis, right? As far as did it necessarily happen or not necessarily happen historically, that's a separate point, which we can hopefully address next week. But the answer there's no short answer. It's a extremely long question to explain, you know, what do we do with the ones that don't fit with the simple meaning of the text and that are clearly skipped in the text, but we'll hopefully try and address them a little bit. So, but let's get back to the to the PowerPoint. Hopefully we will be able to, there we go. Let's see, one second from the slide. Second. Slideshow. There we go. Okay. So we get the chart. Again, we're not going to go through all of these here. There'll be more selective lists later on that'll hopefully be a little easier for use. Okay, so now, we said Midrash Halakha, right? That was the first category. So it's listed first because it is historically first, right? As we saw on the chart, right? So, right, you see that right column. See, notice they're all grayed out, not counting Seder Olam Perek Shira, which are an entirely separate story, which we'll hopefully save for another time. Right, so you'll see, like, all those there, those are all halakhic midrashim. So we say halakhic midrashim, right? So it means that they are collections of halakhic statements of various tanaim, and tanaim meaning people from the, you know, first through third century CE, generally, that also sometimes has intermittent stories as well, because I'm sure many people have sat through halakhic discussions and noticed that many a rabbi will also include stories, because, well, you want people interested, and also sometimes the story is excellent for illustrating a halakhic point. So those are also in it as well. But primarily, you would say that they are halakhic statements. So there are many commentaries. There are several more recent modern day commentaries on written on them, trying to trace how they're quoted practically halakhically. But that is such as works of the Netziv, the Rabbaz. And many others, but we will leave that as it is for now, and we'll continue just simply with the actual source themselves and leave the super commentaries for later. So according to Rav David C. Hoffman, a rabbi in Germany in the late 19th or 20th century, who did a lot of work in this regard in terms of organizing it as well as in terms of rediscovering some. So he categorized the Midrashim, right, into two basic schools. Because as when you read Mishnah or Gemara, there's certain manners of exposition that is used and certain didactic tools. And such as mentioned before about Kal Vachomer, things like that. So there are certain drashot that certain rabbis use and certain rabbis don't use. So based on that, you can largely was that a question? Or I'll assume not. Okay. Yeah, feel free to unmute if you have any questions. So one school of thought is that of the school of Rabbi Akiva, right? Many of us, I'm sure we've all heard of Rabbi Akiva. We're currently in the Omer period, right? Where unfortunately many of the students of Rabbi Akiva passed away due to not honoring one another. But Rabbi Akiva did have some students who ended up surviving. For more on that, right. So Rabbi Akiva, right? So he founded his own school, had many students. And even after those who passed away, he again refounded his school and had more students, which are quoted throughout his Midrashim as well as throughout the rest of Mishnah and Gemara. So he had one on each of the four books, right? So on Shemot, Vayikra, Midbar, and Dvarim. The reason why there isn't one on Reishit for Midrash Halakha is because there aren't really any halakhot to speak of in Sefer Reishit, because the book of Genesis is largely stories and narrative, but it does not have the mitzvot. The first mitzvah actually comes in Parshat Bo, so that is where the Midrash Halakha generally starts.
Not Gid HaNasher?
I mean, it gets restated later, which is where it's quoted, even though you're not going to make a whole book on, I mean, there are whole books written on Gid and Asher, but for the purposes of halakhically, the answer, it's simply, you wouldn't make a whole separate school on that. You'd simply say, okay, well, when we do general kashrus, we're going to kind of stick it in there too, when it comes up later, as opposed to the story there. So you'll note that some of them are underlined and some are not underlined. So the underlined ones are ones that survived intact till today. Meaning as in we have, you know, tradition of this was copied again and again, and we know this is for sure it. The ones that are not underlined are ones that we are not entirely, that we have fragments of or have reconstructed to some degree. The one that's been mostly reconstructed is Mechutzot Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who you might name myself familiar with approaching Lag BaOmer. Right. So that's been reconstructed again. If you want to hear more on that, let me know, and I can devote more time another week to it. But yeah, that's it. Maybe we'll do that. On Lag BaOmer, we'll see. Currently, we're not planning on having class then because I assume everybody would want to. Instead of hearing a shir, would like to go to a bonfire instead because it'll be nice out, supposedly, a couple of weeks. So people tell me I don't know if to believe them or not. So that might happen. So right, and then we have the school of Rabbi Yishmael, right? So this is school of Rabbi Akiva. Those are the four books on each of them, right? There also are parallel. Missing one on. We don't have that of Rabbi Yishmael on Vayikra, but again, you see that there are more. There's the Rabbi Yishmael, the teaching of Rabbi Yishmael on Shemot, the Sifrei, and the Mefilta. So as far as what each of these words mean, like does it tell anything about the nature of each of the words? The answer is, not really. Because the term mechilta, doesn't actually the meaning is more towards the fact of one second, let me still check the translation of here we go. So the translation of mechilta is a mida or a shita, meaning the trait or the shita doesn't translate well. A way of explaining things. We'll call it that. Like mida or mida, meaning let's say like the yigimul midot, the 13 principles in which we expound from the Torah, right? In terms of like from the sense of law, and then when we say sifra, that means a singular sefer. When you say sifrei, it means in Aramaic multiple books. So in fact, all of the names we have for the names of the works of midrash simply mean either book or law, and don't necessarily actually tell us much about them. The more descriptive is the fact is that what they're on. So one that has the best descriptive name actually is that of the Sifra, Shalakol Torah Kohanim, the Torah of the priests, right? The laws of the priests, because Vayikra largely deals with that, which is why that he received that title. Yes, Miriam.
So when you say the school of Rabbi Akiva, the school of Rabbi Yishmael, do we sort of picture their students sitting around and compiling this, or why do we give the name school of so and so? What was their involvement in putting it together?
So their involvement putting it together is the statements largely like with the Mechilta, where it says like where it's translated as midah. So let's say the Yid Gimel Midot. So during Shacharit, right, we say Rishmal Omer B'Shloshes Trei Midot to Rad Nesher Midrash Behemer. The 13 manners we expound from the Torah and it comes to all conclusions. So he has his 13 Midot. Rabbi Akiva has slightly different Midot the way he expounds with. So for instance, they would use slightly different manners in terms of driving their halacha, and they would have a different conclusions also.
So they develop these tools, or they also had a Masorah that they
had a Masorah to use these tools. This is the easiest way of explaining it. How exactly that works out, it's complicated because there are certain ones that you can still the one that can still be done even today, and which the also meaning is an IE that you did not need Sanhedrin to be doing, and you did not need a previous tradition, is that of a Kal Chomer, an a fortiori argument, right? If this, then even more so that. But in general, they were all done with perdition. Hopefully that's clear. Okay, right? So this is the different Midrashai Halakha that exist. And, right, you'll note, again, they're on Shemot, Vayikra, Midbar, and Dvarim, because that they're coming to explain the various Halakhot as they're learned out from those books of the Torah. And then we have the Midrash Agadah, right? This is when normally when you thought of Midrash, this is what you'd have thought. So, and as far as within them, right, you can divide it largely into two basic categories. One of them is the Agadic works, meaning there are Midrashim that are telling a story that sometimes isn't even included whatsoever in the biblical text. And then we have Midrashim that are expounding upon various words or verses in an exegetical fashion. So we have some of them that are called. So these midrashim go by different names. So we have, right? So as far as the standard, So the standard one is, again, interpretive midrash. That's the one.
How do we say that in Hebrew? What are the two categories?
So the two words are midrash parshani, right? That's interpretive. And then homiletical is darshani, right? So the way it's easy way to remember it is interpretive is when you think of, you know, the commentators on the, think of the, it's where the Tanaim are behaving similar to the, what, let's say if you were reading Rashi would do. Whereas homiletical darshanim is the way it was what you'd expect more to hear out of, let's say, the rabbi's drasha on Shabbos morning. As in, it's not necessarily, you know, like meant, I mean, sometimes they are halachic, but oftentimes they're, you know, a good story, a good message, a good moral, lesson learned, but not necessarily, you know, telling you what the verse, this is what happened, this is what the verse means. It's just making sense. Okay, good.
In more modern context, is that the type of stuff that like Hasidic rabbis would do? The Sfat Emet, Netivot Shalom, like when they talk about something next up in the Parsha, is that more what they're doing, homiletical?
More often they lean towards homiletical, but they do more than just that. In general, if you had to categorize it, I would call them homiletical. Whereas, let's say a commentator such as Ibn Ezra, who is very much trying to seek out what the words mean, what's the meaning of the pasuk, that would be interpretive. So you could go do it. So there are some that blend and bridge both sides. So that's why I'm gonna not give a real answer.
What about someone like Unkelus? Is that just a translation, or is there a little bit of a midrash in him as well sometimes?
So I would forward you towards the series I gave. On Unkelus this past fall. I'll send you the link. Remind me, I'll email me and I'll send you the, you know, it's on my Torah. I'll send you the summary. But in short, that every translation has interpretation. Degree of which it has additional midrashic elements depends on the translation. Some are heavily influenced by the various midrashim. Some are minimally, but you will always need to have some degree of midrash or at least of some sort of oral law explaining it, because you can't simply take everything at face value, as we'll hopefully see in a little bit. Yes, Chaya.
I'm just curious about how old that categorization into Darshani and Parshani is. Just because I know, like, Medrash Halacha versus Medrash Agada, like, that's a very old distinction, as I understand it. Is that, like, a more recent, like, sort of, like, obviously they already existed in that way, but for someone to look at them and be like, oh, we have two things going on here.
So
is that...
As in exact dating of it, I'm not entirely sure. I was reading there's a nice book again, but I'm not really knowledgeable. We'll actually go through the history of that. If you want to look at it more, as well as who coined which phrase, I simply didn't. I mean, I read for content, not for exactly when the development of categorization went. So I apologize. I don't recall, but good point.
Thank you.
Okay. So. Right, so now we've got the Midrash Haggadah. So, right, so that's the basics of it, the basic forms. But now the question is, what is the aim of the various Midrashim? Like, what are they trying to solve? So I'm going to be utilizing, again, there's a book by Dr. Moshe Shimon Shoshan. You can find it on the VBM, or also known as etzion.org.il, the virtual Midrash of Yeshiva Har Etzion, where he goes through... the book is primarily about Vayikra Rabba and its homiletical approaches, but he gives it in the intro there. He explains some of the why do we have a Midrash Haggadah and what's it doing there, right? When it's clearly not, you know, explaining the halakha with something else, like what is it doing, right? So, for instance, in terms of the Agadic one, so this is everything that has the word blank Rabba, right? So, I brought here a Midrash Rabba on Vayikra. So, I mean, you can see the little screen in the corner there. If you're a person, again, feel free to flip through it. You also find it in basically every shul. Right? You'll see that it's the way that, like, in the way it's organized, that it's not really, right? You'll see that it's, you know, that it doesn't really read like, you know, other things that you're used to reading. It doesn't read like Midrash says or anything else. But rather, it's a collection of different statements with different aims in mind. Right? There's a lot, so we say Midrash, there's a lot of different small sections that describe other other parts, right? So they often have, you know, like they say a patach, like an intro, which we'll hopefully we'll get to, and we'll explain more of. But for now, we'll just know that it's not, you know, a person doing it. It's many different individuals, and they're collected in that work. As far as looking inside, get an interest of time, I don't think we'll have time to do that today. So, but as far as what the goal is of these midrashim, so one of them is textual concerns, right? You're trying to figure out what, again, so this is, so Prince Peter Musner said, obvious significance, right? Everywhere the Torah has to have a meaning. So he says that, so a lot of the midrashim are saying, why is it this word, not that word? Not simply, sometimes, you know, you think, oh, it's just because they had to say a full sentence. They had to put all the words in, because I can't just say, you know, if I spoke without, you know, verbs, you know, you know, adverbs, etc., it wouldn't sound like words. So therefore, some words are just in for that. But generally, Midrash will be saying, you know, why it's this word, not that word, why it's this punctuation, not that punctuation. And beyond simply the fact that, well, that's how grammar, there's no actual meaning behind every single letter and word as to be found in the Torah or Nevi'im or Ketuvim, right? Any of the books of Tanakh. There also will be times when they're trying to fill in gaps, right, where we have text goes from point A to point B, and we're not quite sure how we got there, right? So Miriam mentioned earlier the question of Avraham Avinu. So the issue is we know that Avraham Avinu was born. We know that he, you know, marries Yiska / Sarai. We know that one of his brothers die, and then he moves to Haran. And then all of a sudden God says, hey, Avraham, you're gonna be the leader of the Jewish people. Lech Lecha. And we're like, what? Right? So there's a lot of Midrashim explaining what exactly happened there, right? How did Avraham become Avraham, right? It's not like magic, right? He must have done something, right? So Midrashim will fill in what happened, right, in Avraham's life. And as far as you get, and we'll say, here's this happened, then that happened, right? The story of the fiery furnace, is destroying his father's idols. Right, so those are all fill-ins for a gap, right? The text doesn't say what, we need to know what happened there, so we fill it in. So hold off the questions, just want to go through all the categorizations, and hopefully it'll also answer some of your questions. So as far as another option is also dialogue between distant verses, like sometimes we have one verse saying one thing, another verse saying another one, and you're trying to make sure that they seem to be contradicting, but the Midrash is saying, no, you simply misread this, or if you had this other fact, you know that it works just fine. And it weaves together the various statements that might appear to be contradictory, but actually, when you read it this way, it makes it all fit together nicely as one unified story and narrative. All right. So again, so that's to result. All right. Also, sometimes it creates thematical and acoustic connections, which would also work in our favor. The next thing that often comes up is that they're trying to address ideological concerns. Right. A philosophical issue might come up based on a verse, based on the Parsha. And so the Midrash takes the time to address that issue, right? There's something in terms of our belief system that is that our memory has been jarred by the verses we're reading. So we should make sure that we know what it's talking about, because we should know we should have a clear ideology. And then there's also the question of aesthetic or artistic concerns, right? Sometimes the question is, why is, you know, so like, what did it actually look like? You know, it's like, you know, more filling out the scene, the details involved, right? Just said, you know, sometimes, you know, there are sometimes where we see a lot of detail, let's say by the splitting of the sea, right? You know, that it was, you know, walls on the right, walls on the left, the Egyptians coming in and being dry for the Jews, but wet for the Egyptians, and their axles break, and tons of details. And other times when we get, you know, like a word, and then it's like, wait, I don't understand what that word means. And the Midrash comes in and we'll fill it in. Also, sometimes it will explain some of the poetics behind it as well. Again, for each of these, it would take a lot, again, give you examples at a later time. But for now, just generally, that is something that the Midrash tends to fill in terms of adding to the text. Okay? So does that answer most people's questions in regards to the basic goals of Midrash and things accomplished? There are other things too, but this is like the basic. Overall, Midrash is probably towards this, unless it's, you know, in the homiletical ones, but that generally falls under ideological, but that would cover most Midrashi. But there will also be debate, because there are rabbis trying to explain verses, and they will of course, have different answers in that regard. Okay?
I have a question.
Yes.
There's a famous Rashi where Rashi says Bilam practiced bestiality. Is that a medrash? Or like what yes. is that?
Yes. So Rashi would be called a collator of Midrashim, as well as a writer of Midrashim, depending on the way you explain that, because Rashi knew the entirety of the corpus of the Midrashim, although some of them don't even have that didn't necessarily survive in Midrash and like the Bereishit Rabbah, Midrash Rabbah, etc. Rashi took a lot of them and then wove them together into a unified narrative. Exactly how and what that means is a good question. If you want to see more on that, I recommend a chapter by Dr. Avigail Rock in her book on the various parashanim, where she goes through the methodology of Rashi. I believe if it's available for English on English online on Yeshiva Hartzvi's website, but there's also many other books that do it as well. Just that's a short, concise, you know, like 10-minute read as opposed to, you know, a 500-page book. So Rashi does that, right? So Rashi does quote Midrashim, and also he will himself also make the Midrashim not necessarily fit. So he's often a Midrash on Midrashim, but for more on that, we will again recommend taking a look at Dr. Vigal Rock's book on that. She'll also quote other sources to look at as well. Okay?
Is there sometimes Midrashim when the rabbis have an agenda? Like either, you know, there are things going on in history with, let's say, non-Jews and something doesn't read very comfortably.
So, I mean, not entirely sure what you're referencing, but sometimes there are times when they would interpret in terms of what's happening at the time period. There's also times when it's simply just like Russia nowadays, where the messages can be applied to modern day. I would need to, but it's not with an agenda, but it will often have or come out as a result of a occurrence that happened in reality, oftentimes, like or stimulate the midrash. But generally, agenda, there's a good, like when you have a homiletical drasha, right? You have a message that you have like an idea that you're aiming towards, that you're thinking of, but generally not necessarily, I wouldn't term that agenda. I'd say that's more of the message.
Well, I mean, when you have something like the Peshat that reads one way, and then what the Midrash says is Reuven slept with Bilhah.
I've got an answer. So that I can answer. So that generally is, so how do you deal with the fantastical elements in the Midrash? Right? How do you do the Midrashim that seemingly don't make any sense, whether it means in physical sense or in terms of with the sense of the verses? So what do you do? So, right, so one option is you simply say Midrash is silly, right? But that's not really a good option. So let's try and take it a little more seriously than that. So like all people say, that's just not pshat, that's not what it means, and then ignore all of Midrash. But that's, we'll see, right? We'll see two opinions as to why that's a bad idea to do. And then I think we'll be out of time for this evening. So first, let's take a look at the Rambam. Right, so the Rambam is an introduction to the 10th parak of the Mishnah Sanhedrin, also is parak Chelek, which has a lot of things about end of days and the world to come and other stories of that nature that are very confusing. For more on that, I recommend you give it a read. The Mishnah and the Gemara, they're a lot of fun, but it'll take you a while. So in the meantime, so here's the Rambam, it's introduction to it, so you can get through without being confused. So, but so part of it, he says, there's three people who go into reading these Agadic Midrashim, and they have a lot of different views on it. First, again, this is the translation is from Svaria. Again, so it's a translation of a translation. I apologize for not knowing Judeo-Arabic, but here's what we got. So, the first one is that according to the simple meaning, right, Sumi believes that Midrashes happen exactly as stated, and there's not reason they have any sort of esoteric meaning, right? They view it as, you know, it says that Moshe was 15 feet tall, therefore Moshe was 15 feet tall. Book.
Rivka was 3 years old when she met.
We'll get to that kind of like that in terms of like why that might have more basis. But, you know, this is more like saying the ones that, you know, let's say that Og lifted up a mountain to crush the Jews with, right? So you're like, well, I mean, what? Right. So those are ones that are like, I just don't understand. Like, how could this possibly exist? It doesn't fit well in your mind. For other ones, again, that require interpretation, that's like it was being three. So what does that mean? Is it really three? That's also only one opinion. Some say she was 13. Some say, like a teenager. That's Ibn Ezra again. But again, the people who say that everything in Midrash happened, right? The literalists, right? No matter what Midrash says, it happened, it has to happen. So they are possible things which correspond to reality. They do this as a result of their not understanding wisdom. They are far from sciences and do not have wholeness, so that they are aroused on their own. They did not find someone to arouse them, right? Basically, so they are simply having fun. They come to these conclusions on their own. And there's no actual halachic or reasonable basis to this at all, right? Next up, we have another group, which is also quite numerous. And they're the ones who heard the words of the sages or heard someone else saying them and understood them literally, right? Right, and according to, and therefore, as a result of hearing that the rabbis say such things, they think the rabbis are fools, right? Which is also a problem, right? So then they mock over to the sages and say that everything the rabbis say makes no sense. So on the one hand, we have those who simply say it must have happened, even when it does not translate into modern logic. And on the other hand, we have those saying, well, that's not that, you know, because it doesn't fit logic, therefore we just throw it all out. Right, so this is Rambam. He's a rationalist. It's his interpretation of when Midrash doesn't work. So he says some people say they take it as truth, even though there's no way that it could have happened. There's no way that's what they meant, but you'll take it literally anyways. Therefore, it's like, I don't know why you think that's what happened, because that's probably not what happened. Also, it doesn't feel safe with the words itself, right? You know, as in we have, you know, how can you say that there are Midrash that contradict each other? Right, so what do you mean? Like, they can't be. They can't all be true. So, like, that's also what it fit. And so those are the two groups you generally find. Those who, like, think every Midrash must have happened, no matter who said it, even if there's five dissenting opinions, they will all still think that it is one individual who said it, and they'll try and make it all work, even though, let's give an example, right, basically with Avraham Avinu. So Avraham, you know, what made Avraham Avraham was that he discovered God. And so the question is, when did Avraham discover God? So was he 3? Was he 40? Was he 60? Did he discover God because he was taught by Noah or Rashi Be'ever? Did he discover it, you know, by means of philosophical grounds, right? All these are various midrashim explaining how Avraham came to understand God and then become Avraham. But as a note, he couldn't have simultaneously discovered God at all those ages that are offered because, well, that's, I mean, you discover, generally you would find God once and then believe in, and you can't rediscover from when, you can't rediscover what you found once unless you start saying that he had amnesia frequently, which is, again, getting absurd, and therefore we can't go with that. So, but what should you do then with all these different midrashim, right? Some of which fit well, some don't fit well. So what do you do? So the Rambam says, here's what you're going to do with them. So here's this is the group that doesn't really exist. This is the third, as God lives, is very small to the point that it is not fitting to call them a group, except in the way that one says about the sun, that it is a species, even though it is in fact the only sun revolving around our earth, right? So, and these are the same people whom the greatness of sages made they be blessed. And the quality of the intellect was made clear. For that was found among their words, things that indicate matters that are very true. Right? Even if, let's say, they can't, all the Midrashim can't be true, or they contradict either logic or themselves, you can also say that, well, maybe I'm not reading it correctly, right? And even though they're scattered in different places in their compositions, they indicate their wholeness and that they grasp the truth, the possibility of the impossible, and the necessity of that which exists was also clear to them. Members of the third group knew that the sages, peace be unto them, were not saying jokes, and it became established for them that the sages' words have revealed any secret meaning. And then in everything they said about that are impossible, they're speaking by way of riddle and a parable. So this is the way of great wise men. Right. So what do you do when things don't make sense? So odds are you didn't understand what the rabbi had to say. Right. That's most likely. Right. If you think that doesn't make any sense, you weren't listening properly. Right. A lot of times when you hear something fantastical, right, it's because they were giving you a story. And stories are meant to have fantastical elements. They're meant to be engaging and fun. And sometimes they don't make sense when you hear it afterwards. Like, that's a great story. Be like, wait, that couldn't have happened, could it? So, and then that'll be that. And so, yeah, but you should, there will be truth in the words of the sages. It might be literal truth. And then I either say this is what actually happened. Sometimes they're simply stating that this is a, you know, a message to be learned. But for more on that, we'll hopefully try and explore more of that as we go on. But some people won't be satisfied with that. They're like, okay, so that's the Rambam. Basically sounds like he's saying that if something doesn't make sense, it can only have a non-literal interpretation. So that's not, we don't like that. So then we also have the Shilta Giborim, Rabbi Yeshua Baruch from the 16th century in Italy. You may know him more as the, so the Shilta Giborim is a commentary on the Rif, but you may know him as the Masoret HaShatz, or the Torah Or, or the Ein Nishbat Ner Mitzvah that you will find on the side of the Talmud Bavli, right? So he is that individual, right? So again, knows a ton. So here's explaining that idea. So seeing that we're running short on time, so I'll say it mostly outside. So he says that there's people, you know, see this and then they mock the Torah because the Midrashim are silly, right? From that second group that Rob mentioned. What do you say? So you explain that some of the Midrashim that you see are exaggerations, right? We often say, like, such as the case of when we say that these cities were fortified to the heavens. No, there weren't. The walls in ancient Canaan did not go up, you know, into the stratosphere all the way to the heavens, right? It's hyperbole. It's way of language to say that they were really, really well fortified. And many examples to that effect. And that can be some of the cases. It's meant for, you know, again, embellishment, not meant to take it literally. Two, some are saying no. Like, there are some midrashim that were viewed to be fit and worthy to be recorded in the text itself, right? That we see miracles happening all throughout the Torah and Tanakh, right? But on the other hand, we have ones where, like, right? Again, Yonah being swallowed by the big fish, Daniel seeing things like prophecy when the people actually don't see anything, right? Those are miraculous elements. So just like they can happen in Tanakh, they can happen outside of Tanakh. They have a tradition that it happened. Does it necessarily make sense? No, but it's a miracle, right? And miracles don't make sense. That's the point. They're miracles. And you can argue, did this miracle happen or not happen? Different discussion. But a lot of times, it's the sages saying, we have a tradition this miracle happened, and that's perfectly fine and reasonable and likely. Or sometimes that would be expanding upon a previous miracle. There also are some which are homiletics, right? They are making exposition, they're doing a drasha, right? So therefore, you should not be surprised that, you know, they're taking a verse, like, no, the verse definitely didn't mean what you said it meant. It clearly was just talk, you know, by the barashim moshalemor, right? God told Moshe saying, that's all he meant to say, and that was it. It's like, true, but there could be another meaning, right? Just like when somebody's speaking to you, they might have the obvious thing that they're saying versus the more hidden meaning, right? They can actually have both. So that's Shulta Gibor's opinion. And an example he gives is the question of, you know, did Yaakov Avinu die, right? So one of the Gemara says, one of the sages, Yitzhak says, I mean, said that he didn't die. I'm not like, wait a minute, but like the Pesukim say he died. They have a whole eulogy for him. They embalm him and everything else. So what do you mean he didn't die? Right? We know where he's buried, right? Like, what are you talking about? He's very, very dead. We know he's dead. What are you saying? And the answer is, I'm interpreting a verse, right? Mikra ani doresh, I'm expounding a verse, and that's that. So what does that mean? So Shulta Gibor explains, right? I know the Yaakov died, but I'm trying to expand upon the verse in any way that I can, because there's a deeper meaning behind the fact that we say that Yaakov didn't die. Not that he, you know, yes, we know he died, right? But there's something that we gained from the fact that he didn't die. For instance, the fact that they say that even in death, the righteous are alive, since their name and their actions and their memories continue to live in this world because of what they've done, right? So that would be an instance of something you can definitely take from the fact that Yaakov Avinu never died because, well, we have his teachings, we have the Torah, like quoting many things that Yaakov said, right? We're called Bnei Israel, named after Yaakov. Right, so quite clearly, so even though Yaakov died, he didn't really die, and therefore, even though you say that can't be, the answer is it really can be. So seeing as tonight is as Yom HaShoah, so I figure now's a good time to mention that again, so that we are, you know, that many people may have been up for the UJA thing earlier, right? The UJA event in the park, and many people on Zoom as well, sorry, or live cast, whatever they call it now, right? So what Trimble will say, we mentioned before, of the fact that the actions and the memories of the individuals. So hopefully, you know, tonight's learning will all hopefully will, you know, for many of us will, again, hopefully, you know, even though the members that many, the millions who passed away in the Holocaust are no longer here, but hopefully, you know, their names and their actions will serve to lead us forward, and also serve to, we should, you know, remember them for their sacrifice. So, now back to to summarize the what we've covered so far. So again, main points that we covered are that there are two main types of midrash: midrash halacha and midrash akadah. Which are different groupings of Tanakh material that are edited over several centuries, right? Some of which were starting from the third all the way through the 14th. Again, they have different opinions, just like Mishnah and Gemara do. So not necessarily one whole thing. And we dealt with some of the ways to deal with the miraculous elements. Say that they're not necessarily miraculous. Sometimes they are miracles, but a lot of times it's simply we didn't understand them correctly. Their exaggeration, or they're to set the scene, not necessarily because they just simply happened. But there are also many times when it does help to explain the verses, and therefore we'll hopefully be able to explore more of that as well. So I just wanted to remind everybody that also that next week we will not be meeting, because next week is Yom Zikaron / Yom Ha'atzmaut and the Tekkes. So I hope to see everybody there in person. So happy to discuss Midrash. If you find me there, I'm happy to talk about Midrash as well, but it'll be a night hopefully for celebration. And again, if anybody would like to sign up for the listing, for the recording, or for the sources, again, please feel free to write your email in chat or send me an email at cmetzger@torontotorah.com. And last but certainly not least, because we're in the Omer, I can't end without telling everybody, because now it is definitely after Sefer Chaim. So for those who have not yet counted the Omer, the bracha is on the screen, as well as the, and in English, because when you're saying the Omer, it's important to know what you're saying and that you're what you're counting. So please feel free to count if you have not yet counted. And also, if you've not repeated, if you've not said Shema yet as well, that is also another mitzvah that can be fulfilled right now as well, or immediately following this year.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Does anybody have any questions?